Okay, we want to cover the curricular problems that you encountered.
In the earliest days, there were meetings in which various people got together to talk about what we're going to teach these guys. I mean, they're coming. Now, what are we going to do with them? And we gravitated toward things rather than, well, there were some obvious things. You've got to teach them anatomy. You've got to teach them physiology. But you also need to teach them specifics. And we began to teach them how to do electrocardiograms, how to do suturing, how to draw blood, things that today look kind of simplistic and have proved to be just sort of inconsequential details. But essentially, we came out with teaching them things that those who were around at that time thought were important. And this was not the systematic look at the situation that I described earlier about from the Bowman Gray program, in which you looked at 100 diseases and looked at what anatomy do you need in order to handle those 100 diseases, what physiology do you need, what biochemistry do you need, what pharmacology do you need. Now that's the part that we just missed entirely. And I think the early criticisms of our curriculum were exactly on the mark, that we were trying to teach them to be young physicians rather than young physician assistants. And there's a difference.
Were there other problems that you recall from that stage in the development?
No problems. I think things went reasonably smoothly as far as the teaching went. I mean, we had young people who were bright, and they picked up what they needed.
Your teachers?
Yeah, and students as well.
How did you select the teachers? And did you have to beg some, or did they step forward quite willingly?
Well, at that time, it was very simple. Gene Stead said, "You will do it." And so we didn't argue with Gene Stead. We did it. That was the beginning. And there was a person who was very important at that point, and this was Jim Moe, M-A-U, whose name has probably come up before, because he was the interface between Gene Stead and the program. Gene Stead depended on Jim Moe as an administrator to get things done, and we all knew that Jim Moe spoke with the voice and authority of Gene Stead behind him, and so Jim Moe got things done.
Now, very rapidly, you had another problem, and that was how to limit the enrollment, right? Because this caught fire very quickly.
Caught fire quite quickly. I forget how long it took us to get up to 40, but it got there fairly fast. At first, it was 4 or 5, and then 7 or 8, and then all of a sudden, it was 40. And we stopped at 40 because that's as big as a classroom would hold. And it turned out that we could have done it with twice that number, but 40 looked like a nice classroom full.
How long did 40 remain the limit?
It's still kind of the... now, we go over at times, but I think Reg tells me that 40 is still the basic number. Now, we do have some students at some peripheral places that do things electronically, but they are in addition to the 40, but 40 is generally the number. It's just a nice-sized class.
I mentioned this matter of co-germination that other PA-type programs were developing about the same time. Speak about that.
Yes. Why did the PA program catch on? And I point out that the PA program started at the same time that family medicine was also starting, and that the nurse practitioner movement was also starting, and the MedEx program, and everything was going on at the same time. And my conjecture is that they all arise from the same basic problem, and that was the lack of generalist physicians out there in the country at large. And I think my way of putting it together goes like this. At the beginning of World War II, let's say in 1940, 41, every doctor out there was not every doctor, but the majority, the vast majority of all doctors were generalists. They were trained under the old system of 4 years of medical school and a year of rotating internship. Some few went ahead and got some specialties, but they were all generalists, and they had distributed themselves widely over the country. They went into the service. They quickly learned that there was an advantage in being a specialist. They were given a GI Bill as a result of their service, and many of them came back and used their GI Bill in order to get a specialty. One that I can think of was a general practitioner and came back and became an otorhinolaryngologist by using his residency, his GI Bill sponsorship in order to get that. Well, that was common. But at the end of World War II, we were no longer training generalists. I remember, because in 1966 I looked at it as part of my new assignment in my new department, there were something like 200 residencies for general practice available in the country that were labeled that. There were lots of people, not lots, but a few people who went and got 1 year of medicine and 1 year of pediatrics and 1 year of OB and maybe 6 months of surgery and put it together themselves. But there were 200 out of all the residences in the U.S. that were designated for family medicine or for general practice. Those were half unfilled. And of those that were filled, the majority were people from other countries who were coming in and moving into soft spots where they could get in without difficulty. So everybody was moving in the direction of specialization. Now, this doesn't have its impact immediately, but essentially from 1945, at the end of World War II, until 1966, we had not trained any generalists. And the doctors that were there were beginning to retire and beginning to die and beginning to need replacement. And as these doctors went back to medical schools to find their replacements, there were none. This was true all over North Carolina. I remember the calls of desperation that came to our new department because everybody said, aha, we've got this new department that's supposed to solve these problems. We'll give you a telephone number to call. So we got a call from a doctor in the eastern part of the state named Ernest Ferguson, who became a good friend. And we sent our first PA to him, by the way. Ernest Ferguson, 70 years old in a eastern North Carolina town, says, send me a doctor, please. We don't have a doctor, Dr. Ferguson. But I'm 70 years old. I can't stand every other night. My partner is older than I am. But we don't have one. But we sent him Craig Bruno, one of our first graduates, who stuck with him until he died. Well, that problem was there all over the country in spades. And out of that problem came the PA program, the nurse practitioner program, and the family practice program, and lots of other programs. And the problem is still with us. It's still there. In 1998, same damn problem that I am tackling every week when I go to work. But it's the basis for all of the interest in the programs.
Why did the generalists lose allure so quickly and so permanently?
Medicine is a complex process. There was no family medicine program at that time. People that were training general internists were training them like themselves to be the people that were training general internal medicine at Duke were cardiologists and gastroenterologists and endocrinologists. That was the glamour in the subspecialties. And if you were anybody at all, you wanted to be a subspecialist, like those giants that trained you. In my day, 20 years earlier, Gene Stead, John Hickam, Jim Warren were, first of all, good general internists who were beginning to pick up some specialties. But the training was general internal medicine 20 years earlier. So it's there is another thread that feeds in here, and it goes back to the same era of 1945, and it's another piece of it, and it's one that I ought to mention. It was 1950 when we began to see the National Institutes of Health come on the scene. By 1955, the National Institutes was beginning to pour money into medical schools for research. And out of that research came lots of information, not new knowledge, new techniques, new machines, transplantation, cardiac catheterization, angiography. I mean, you could name dozens of things out of every field that came out of the investment that the federal government made in the 50s and 60s. So all of the output of that investment was beginning to be apparent by 1966. So we were fighting powerful forces. It was only the rebels that wanted to be rebels and to go back and be generalists in order to do what these old GPs did.
So the program at University of Washington sprung forth.
Yep.
Silver in Colorado sprung forth.
Right.
What about Bowman Gray? How did that come about?
Well, it joined with the Duke program as one of the earliest PA programs and became strongly entrenched in its own local community and has continued to produce 40 PAs a year. The number 40 keeps coming up. I mean, Bowman Gray, until fairly recently, was the other program in our state that took 40 a year. And so we were sister programs within one state.
But Duke also spawned programs in other parts of the country, like with Bill Stanhope, who
right.
went to Oklahoma and so forth.
There were people who were in the early programs who became the gurus of the new profession, the Bill Stanhopes, and who went forth and became the teachers and leaders that got the profession started and got the academy started, got the put together the internal machinery that made the profession a profession.
So there's no question in your mind that Duke occupies a very preeminent place in the...
Yeah. And I think we fought some of the early battles with... I think almost every state has adopted this model legislation in one form or another that we put together back there, and that's become kind of a standard.
Now, we breezed past that, but actually that took up a lot of your time, didn't it?
A lot of time, yeah.
And not only in terms of writing, but also...
conferencing and...
meeting with politicians.
Right.
And did you use Stead as your mentor on that, or did you quickly come to understand the political situation in the state?
Well, Gene sort of dropped out of the political situation after he left his chair, but was a trusted advisor and behind-the-scenes person, but sort of left the daily battles up to Bob Howard and me and other people that were out there doing the more daily battles.
I think being effective politically requires a whole bunch of skills that you must have learned growing up in Georgia or something.
Must have.
My note here says we were going to touch on the AMA role.
Right. Now, back in the 60s, I'm sort of leading up to it, but it's indirect, but it has to be. Back in the 60s, there was a new federal legislation called the Regional Medical Program that came into being. And this was about the time our new department started. And the regional medical program was to get the benefits of heart disease, cancer, and stroke research out to the medical community at large in a more effective and more in a quicker way. So as the chair of this new department, the dean said, look, you are Duke's representative on the regional medical program, because I mean that's your departmental responsibility. So I became the chair of the regional medical program for the state, which was all three medical schools at that time, and plus a federal machine that was created to carry out the mandates of that new piece of legislation, which had to do with medical teaching. But it itself spawned a few things, such as the University of North Carolina established an Air Force to carry its teachers around to do teaching as part of the regional medical program, and we funded that. And they now have 5 airplanes that carry people around. The early cancer programs in the state were all done with regional medical program money. But anyway, I became, in this new role, very active with the state of North Carolina's outlying doctors. Very unique at Duke, because very few people at Duke had had that opportunity of going out and meeting their counterparts in other places. Well, I became very active in the local medical society. I went up through the ranks as an officer in the county medical society and was proposed as an officer in the state medical society, and I went up through the ranks there and eventually became president of the medical society in Raleigh. That took from 1966 until roughly 1978, where I became president, and have remained active ever since. And somewhere along the line became active in the AMA, because this is kind of the progression. I became a delegate to the AMA, and became an alternate delegate, then a delegate, and served as a delegate for 9 or 10 years. And after you get known, you become chair of committees, and so I became chair of the Council on Scientific Affairs and eventually its chair. And so yeah, I've been very active in the AMA. I'm now retired, thank God, because it took a lot of time.
I want to ask you your observations on who goes into the PA program over time. Has that changed, and who's doing it now?
It's not changed that much, but it's changed some. In the early days, it was a lot of returning corpsmen, bright people who had been active in the armed forces, and mainly males. But as time went on, we had a more diverse group. Oddly enough, but not odd when you think about it, some nurses who said, look, I want to be a PA. I don't want to be a nurse anymore. So they went in this route instead of becoming a nurse practitioner, and that's still the case. But mixed in with that are a group of people who have become music majors, French majors, economics majors, who have said to themselves, my God, I've always wanted to be an MD. I've always wanted to be involved. And I didn't know that there was any route other than to become a physician and to spend 5 years or 10 years doing it, to do that. And for some reason they learn about this and they say, well, that's exactly what I want to do. And so you find a huge number of those people who have done something else in their lives. They've been teachers, they've been lab techs, they've been economists, they've been, they've been everything. And they have decided that that's exactly what I want to do. Now, we put a barrier in their way here, and I think most places, in that we say, you've got to have some hands-on experience working with patients. So many of those take time out of their lives in order to get that experience, in order to get the 2 years of PA training. So it's a group of people who've done something else, but who have always had a nagging feeling that they wanted to do this, and that feeling is strong enough that they want to really change their lives and do this. And it's a fascinating group of people. They have a social conscience. They don't want to do things the standard way. They question things. They don't let you get away with things. And I think everybody who lectures PAs and medical students will say they're different. I'd rather lecture the PAs, most of them, because they question things. It's a different group. The medical students, many of them are lockstep. They've been competing from the time they were 12 to be the first in their class and to be the top of their class, and they've not done anything else. And the PA group is different. Many of them are older. They are more challenging.
Describe the requirement that they have had service before they enter the program. What does that entail?
Well, this was from the beginning, and it came from the second year, as I recall. In the second year, the class admitted, or to the class was admitted, a young woman who wanted to be a PA, but who had never taken care of patients. She had been a lab tech, as I recall. She had worked with the lab things, but she'd never had the responsibility of taking care of patients, and she dropped out because she didn't like taking care of patients. Well, Genestead said at that point, okay, that's it. We're going to require that people have hands-on experience. They have got to get dirty. They've got to be vomited upon. They've got to have an experience of responsibility as a caregiver that's going to help us separate those who are repelled, and I can't use any other word, from the business of serving in a very close way a person who is sick and dependent and calls on you to hold his head while he pukes, and that is not for everybody. And so from the beginning, from that beginning, we have required that there be 1 year of experience in hands-on patient care. Now, we've had lots of people who have taken a year and become patient aides or have become volunteers in emergency rooms or something of that sort in order to get that kind of experience. And I think it is a screening device that gets rid of those who are not damn serious.
So if I apply, the program tells me, go get your year of service in your community, or and doesn't define precisely what that is, I come up with it.
Yep.
And then I document that I've been there and been puked upon, and so forth and so on. So that actually, in a sense, adds a year, although maybe this could be a part-time volunteer
thing. It could be a part-time volunteer job, and often is, and people who are thinking about it go ahead and get that as a part of their preparation. For many of them, take a chemistry course or whatever is necessary in order to make it. And this is a fairly competitive game now.
What about demographically? What generalizations could you make about PAs?
Many more women, older people who've done other things.
Ethnically?
Unfortunately. There's not been as many from ethnic minorities as I would like to see. Now, there are reasons for that, I think. When you put more and more barriers there in terms of educational requirements and other requirements, then you very quickly filter out some ethnic minorities who should be there. Now, we've had some ethnic successes of a sort that I had not expected, because many of the young black men and women who have entered the program in the very early days went ahead very quickly and applied for medical school and are now medical practitioners. This gave them enough confidence to go back and apply to medical school. But as far as PAs, that's, we are searching for ways to do it, and Reg has got some very bright ideas now that have to do with keeping the training in local communities, and he's got a program in Lumberton dealing with a biracial group of minorities, Indians and blacks, that are, that I think has some promise. They're actually taking the program to them so that they don't have to leave home.
And does distance learning factor into that?
Yes, it will. That's going to be a bigger part of it, and it is now to some extent.
What about economic status? Is there any observation you'd make there?
Many people are earning their own way, and I'd say that most are. That most of them are people who've got responsibility for their own payment. And very few have. And this is causing a problem because many of them finish PA programs with debts that are in the 50K range that become a problem unless they go to an underserved area. We've been able to help some repay those. But that's about half of what MDs end with, but it's still a lot.
And what kind of salary do they expect in their first couple of years of practice?
$50,000 to $60,000 right now. It's about the going price is about half that for MDs. It's consistently been that.
So they parallel one another in a way.
They parallel one another.
I wanted to get your observations on why the word physician's assistant was selected.
Okay, that. Has been a bone of contention from the beginning, and at the beginning the word physician assistant was probably okay, and that's the one that Gene Stead put upon them, but there was very quickly a thought that there should be, this is a bit demeaning to be called a physician assistant, and there should be a better word, and there have been several attempts at that, and the word physician associate was had a time of popularity, and there was some attempts to change names of programs to physician's associate, but that didn't stick. And there have been some strange names that have been thought up, such as syniatrist, things that are kind of off the wall, but that would imply that this is a different breed and it doesn't really assist physicians in that sense. There's been no satisfactory answer, and I think the profession has drifted with the term physician assistant without anyone having any feeling that this is the perfect term, and that someday somebody will come along with it. And at that point, everybody will change.
But it was Dr. Stead who said, this is what we're going to call these folks.
Yep, that's right. And MedX is that was a coined word. But it didn't stick for the field as a whole.
Now, if I told you I was going to be interviewing Bob Howard tomorrow, what would you say?
Bob is an interesting guy for whom I have the greatest affection and respect. Now, he's had a troubled life in some ways, but Bob was wound tight, and I think one would predict that he would either spend himself or burn out at some point. He could put more time and energy into a task than anybody I've ever known before or since. Worked day and night. Worked effectively day and night. And had good ideas. And I think burned out here.
What were the circumstances of his departure?
He decided to go elsewhere, to take another position and to be a program director. I'm sure money had something to do with it, and autonomy had something to do with it. And I think he thought he was ready for something else. And as I recall, he went from here to Florida to start a new program there, a responsible job, and he did that. So he left here and. In good stead and in good repute, and did an effective job where he went. But he did have some problems later that were, I think, a consequence of his being the person he was. But he was exactly what we needed and produced effectively.
Did you say you hired him?
Yes.
And his being here for those 4 years were critical.
Critical. And he would travel back and forth, and he would argue, and he would persist, and he would nag, and everything else. And he brought in with him somebody that he had worked with in his past named David Lewis. And Dave eventually became the program director at Florida after Bob left. And David came from a strange background. He'd been a band director. but he and Bob became a team. And Dave was the administrative person, and Bob became the front person who did all the travel and cajoling.
So their role was mainly public relations?
Dave had the job of curriculum, learning objectives, making the transition over to the new model rather than the old Duke model.
And Howard's
Howard's sphere. Had to do with, he was here at the time when we were trying to get the AMA to cooperate and things of that sort.
Dick, is it Sheely?
Sheely. Dick was one of the early graduates of the program. Sort of a model person who became a leader of the PAs who were graduates. Went into practice here in town and tragically died suddenly of a massive coronary. Would have been a leader somewhere, but he was charismatic, very intelligent, very looked up to by other people as leader. And he was very influential in getting the organizational unit that started that became the AAPA.
Do you recall what drew him here, how he arrived? Or
why he came to Duke among our applicants early, and I don't know why he came here. I mean, he was a corpsman. He was out of the military. But why, I guess we were the only game in town at that point.
And was there anything special about the program he entered here in town, or
no?
Special because someone got a job out of the program, right?
Right.
A person that appeared on the panel that I observed the videotape of from the 25th anniversary, Catherine Andreoli.
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 Kay Andreoli was at the point where the PA program was starting. She was the head nurse on the coronary care unit here at Duke. And Kay was married to, at that time, she was married to a physician who was on the faculty as well. And she worked for Andy Wallace, whose name probably will come up lots of times. And Andy Wallace had, he was along with me and several others, had the task of teaching these young people. And he taught them a lot of cardiology. And part of the teaching had to do with learning electrocardiography and learning resuscitative techniques and things of this sort, and Kay Andreoli was a part of that. And so Kay became an early instructor in the program and became one of the early supporters of the program within nursing. She left here to go elsewhere as a leader within nursing, but at the early phases of the program, she was a key person as an instructor, as an ally within a political structure that was hostile. And she later wrote a book with Andy Wallace about interpretation of the electrocardiogram for the coronary care nurse. So she went on to another field, and she was at Alabama for a long time.
So she's never, when she left Duke, she didn't return to Duke.
She did not return. She's now, she's vice president at University of Chicago, I think, or Northwestern right now. She's a very prominent person in nursing in Chicago right now. And a good friend. I think Kay has been a friend since she was here. But she knew it back then. From inside.
Now, the nurse that worked with Stead in the early days, Louise?
Thelma Ingalls.
I knew it was either Thelma or Louise. did once things didn't go with their collaboration, she didn't re-enter the program in any way?
No. In fact, Thelma became, she went overseas. She became an emissary of the Rockefeller Foundation, and she became a staff member with that foundation and went and traveled with, she left the scene.
You mentioned Jim Moore?
Moe, M-A-U.
Right.
Jim is still around, though he's retired. His health has been poor. But he remained as the administrative chief in the Department of Medicine for many years. And when the program moved over to us, he sort of dropped his role with the program, but was remained a supporter and a friend of the program from there till now. He was certainly an important individual early in the program.
From what standpoint?
Whatever you needed a classroom, you needed a few thousand dollars to do this, you needed some hurdle to get over, then Jim Moe was the person to go talk to. Resources mainly, physical resources, space resources. He could generally find it for you. He had lots of irons and lots of fires, and he was owed a lot of nickels by a lot of people who could get things done.
What do you consider your legacy to be in all of this?
Well, clearly it's Gene Stead's idea and Gene got it started. But I think my legacy is fighting it through some of the next battles, the next stages, and getting it on a level playing field. I think I've saved it a few times from being eliminated at Duke by standing up and saying, I think this belongs here. And on the state scene, I think I've been crucial in some of the battles that the profession has had to fight in the state. And so I think I've kept it moving. and I hope I've been friendly at every time to help it, help the profession get over some of the tough spots, to get it introduced at a few places where it needed to be introduced. So I think that's been my role, to sort of take it from the germ of an idea and keep it on the path to the point where it could survive on its own.
Do you remember the day that Stead called you or dropped by your office or had you come to his office and said, hey, I have this idea?
I don't remember specifically the day. It sort of grew because we clearly talked about his nursing program before. We talked about the fireman before. We talked with, I remember talking with Henry McIntosh many times about that. But I don't remember a specific, I don't think there was one. I think it grew like Topsy.
It's interesting how some people's lives take a direction that becomes so defining.
Yeah.
Sort of without, I mean, if anyone had said to you when you were at Emory, well, you know, we need physician's assistants and you're the guy to bring this profession into being, you would have said, what's that all about?
And really it was, when you think back upon it, it was no reason to say that I had to accept it. It would have probably disappeared at that time had I not accepted it, because Jim Weingarten would have not been interested at all. He would have said, as far as I'm concerned, it can disappear tomorrow. And he would have been just as happy.
And under those circumstances, and as a young person in the field at the time, what stopped you from being sort of capitulatory?
I viewed it as something crucially important to the roles of my new department. I really believed in it, and I still do. Just as surely as I believe that family medicine was important, just as surely as I believe that those things were essential for the role of my new department, I believed it. I didn't do it because anybody wanted me to do it.
Now you say in terms of your department, but surely you also mean in terms of a much larger.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Because I took my role as a new department chair because I believe that the university and the medical school should play a role, which I'm gradually seeing take place. After I've left. But I think someday somebody will say, well, maybe he had something to do with it.
That's quite clear. I think this proves it.
but I guess that's the legacy. Because nobody made me do anything.
Are we leaving anything unsaid today?
We've covered a lot more ground than I believed existed, but I don't know of anything.
Well, it's been a wonderful interview. It's been a privilege to sit here and
Well, I've enjoyed it.
Good.